The Trouble with the Cotton People, written by Grey Bull of the Obsidian of Telinana as part of an offering to his Hayamas. When I was a young man, there was trouble with the people who send us cotton from the south in trade for our wines. We were putting good wines on the train to Sedd every spring and autumn, clear Ganais and dark Berena, Mess from Onmalin, and the sweet Betebes they like down there, all good wines selected because they travel well and shipped in the best oak casks. But they had begun sending us short staple, seedy cotton full of tares in short weight bales. Then, one year, they sent half in bales and the rest stuff already woven, some of it fair sheeting weight, but some of it sleazy or worse. That year was the first I went to Sedd with my teacher in the cloth art, Soaring, of the Obsidian of Kastohana. We went down with the wine and stayed at the inn at Sedd, a wonderful place for seafood and general comfort. She and the wine art people had an argument with the foreigners, but it got nowhere because the people who had brought the cotton to Sedd said they were just middlemen. They hadn't sent the lousy cotton, they just loaded and unloaded it, and sailed the ships that carried it, and took the wine back south. The only person there, they said, who was actually from the cotton people, wasn't able to speak any language anybody else spoke. Soaring dragged him over to the Sedd exchange, but he acted as if he'd never heard of Toke, and when she tried to get a message through the exchange to the place the cotton came from, nobody answered. The wine art people were glad she was there, since they would have taken the sleazy without question and sent all the good wine they had brought in return. She advised them to send two-thirds the usual shipment, and no sweet Betebes in it at all, and to take the rest back home and wait to hear from the cotton people. She refused to load the sleazy stuff onto the train, so they put it back into the ships. The ship people said they didn't care, so long as they got their usual share of the wine from us for doing the shipping. Soaring wanted to cut that amount, too, to induce the ship people to pay attention to the quality of their cargo, but the other valley traders said that was unfair or unwise, so we gave the sailors a half carload, as usual, all sweet Betebes. When we came home, there was discussion among the cloth and wine arts and the finder's lodge and the councils and interested people of several towns, and some of us said, "Nobody from the valley has been to that place where the cotton comes from for 40 or 50 years. Maybe some people from here should go there and talk with those people." The others agreed with that. So, after waiting a while to see if the cotton people would send a message on the exchange when they got their sleazy back and less wine than usual, we set out, four of us. Myself, because I wanted to go and knew something about cotton and fabrics, and three finder's lodge people, two who had done a lot of trading and had been across the inland sea more than once, and one who wanted to keep up the finder's maps of the places we were going. They were named Patience, Peregrine, and Gold. We were all men and all young. I was the youngest. I had come inland the year before with a blue clay girl, but when I said I was going to the end of the inland sea, she said I was crazy and irresponsible, and put my books and bedding out on the landing. So I left from my mother's house. I had been busy learning with the cloth art, and had not given much thought to joining the finder's lodge, but the trip to Sedd had made me want to travel more, and I knew I had a gift for trading. I saw no reason to be ashamed of it. I have never cared much what people say, so I went as a novice of that lodge, both a traveler and a trader. In the books I read and the stories I heard as a kid, the finders were always travelers, not traders, and they were generally on snowy peaks in the range of light, singing to the bears or getting toes frozen off or rescuing each other from chasms. The finders I was with appeared not to favor that style of travel. We rode the Amaranth train sleeping car all the way down the line to Sedd and stayed at the inn there again, eating like ducks in a slug patch, while we asked around about ships and boats. Nobody was sailing south. We could get a ship going across to the east coast, to Rekwit, sometime in the month, or as soon as we liked, a boat would take us across the gate to the Phalaris Islands. From either Reckitt or the Phalaris we could try to find a coaster going south, or else go on foot down the inner side of the mountains. The finders decided the chances were better on the west side, and that we should cross the gate. I was sorry when I saw the boat. It was about 15 feet long, with a little farting engine and one sail. The tidal currents run in and out the gate faster than a horse at a gallop, they say, and the winds the same. The boat's people were skinny and white, with fishy eyes, Phalaris Islanders. They talked enough Tok that we could understand one another. They had been in Sedd to trade fish for grain and brandy. They sailed those little boats way out west of the gate, out on the open ocean, fishing. They were always saying, "Ho, ha, go out to big waves, ha, yes," and slapping my back while I was throwing up over the edge of the boat. A north wind was coming up, and by the time we were out in the middle of the water of the gate, the waves were getting very steep and hard, like bright little cliffs. The boat climbed up and dropped down and jerked and slapped. Then the low fog that had been lying over the inland sea, which I had taken for distant land, blew and faded away in a few moments, and there, 100 miles to the east of us, was the range of light, the far glitter of the peaks of snow. Underneath the boat there, Patience told me, the bottom of the sea was all buildings. In the old times, outside the world, the gate was farther west and narrower, and all its shores and the countries inland were covered with houses. I have heard the same thing told in the Madrone Lodge since then, and there's the song about the old souls. It is no doubt true, but I had no wish at the time to go down and verify it, though the harder the wind blew, the likelier it seemed that we were about to do that. I was too bewildered, however, to be really frightened. With no earth to be seen but those tiny white saw-teeth half over the world's curve, and the hard, bright sun and wind and water, it was a good deal like being dead already, I thought. When the next day we finally got ashore onto one of the Phalaris Islands, the first thing I felt was lust. I got a big, long hard-on, and couldn't turn my mind from it. The Phalaris women all looked beautiful, and I had such mindless desires that I was really worried. I got alone, with some difficulty, and masturbated, but it didn't help. Finally, I told Peregrine about it, and he was decent enough not to laugh. He said it had to do with the sea. We talk about living on the coast, being chased, and coming inland, when you stop being chased, and all that may be reversal language. Sex is always turning things around and upside down. He said he didn't know why being on the sea and then coming ashore had that particular effect, but he had noticed it himself. I said I felt as if I'd come back to life with a vengeance. At any rate, a couple of days eating what the Phalaris people eat cured me. All the women began to look like seaweed, and all I wanted was to go on somewhere else, even in a boat. They weren't doing any sailing down the inland coast at that time of the year, but were all going out on the ocean for the big fish. But they were generous people, and some of them said they would take us along the inland coast as far as a place they called Tubberhoney, where one of them had family living. We had to get off the island somehow, so we accepted, although we weren't sure where Tubberhoney was. The Phalaris people chart the seas, but not the lands, and none of our place names seemed to fit with theirs. But anything on the South Peninsula suited us. When we sailed south, the weather was quiet and the waves low. The fog never lifted. We passed a few rocks and islands, and around midday, passing a long, low one, the Phalaris people said, "City." We couldn't see much of it in the fog. It looked like bare rock and some yerba buena and beach grass and a couple of tall, slender towers or masts supported by guy wires. The Phalaris people carried on about it. You touch, you die, and they acted out electrocution or asphyxiation or getting struck by lightning. I never heard any such thing about the cities, but I had never seen one before or since. Whether it was true, or they were having one of their little jokes with us, or they are superstitious, I don't know. They are certainly rather undereducated and out of touch on those islands in the fog. They never use the exchange at Sedd, as if it too were dangerous. They are timid people, except on water. Tubber Honey turned out to be called Gohop on our maps, a little town a short way south of the northern tip of the peninsula, on the inland side. It was sheltered from the everlasting fog of the gate. Avocados grew all over town, and they were just coming ripe when we were there. How the people there could stay thin, I don't know, but they were thin and whitish like the Phalaris people, but not quite so much out on the edge of things. They were glad to talk to travelers and helped Gold plan our trip on his maps. They had no boats going out any distance and said none came by their little port regularly, so we set off south on foot. The peninsula range between the ocean and the inland sea is so buckled up by earthquakes and subsidences and so deeply scored by faults and rifts that walking the length of it is like crossing a forest by climbing up every tree you come to and then back down. There was usually no way round. Sometimes we could walk along the beaches, but in many places there wasn't any beach. The mountains dropped sheer into the sea. So we would plod up and up, clear to the ridge, and from there we saw the ocean to our right and the sea to our left, and ahead and behind the land falling away in fold after fold forever. As we went farther south, there were more long, narrow sounds and inlets in the faults, and it was hard to know whether we were following the main ridge or had got onto a hogback between two rifts, in which case we would end up on a headland staring at the water and would have to go back 10 or 15 miles and start over. Nobody knew how old the maps we had were. They were from the exchange, sometime or other, but they were out of date. Mostly there was nobody to ask directions of but sheep. The human people lived down in the canyons with the water and the trees. They weren't used to strangers, and we were careful not to alarm them. In that part of the world, the young men, late adolescents and older, often form groups and go out and live a hunting life, like our Bay Laurel Lodge, but less responsibly. The bands are allowed to fight each other, and to raid each other and any town except the one they came from, taking tools or food or animals or whatever they want. Those raids lead to killings, of course, sometimes, and some of the men never come back and settle down, but stay out in the hills as forest-living people, and some of them are crazy and kill for the sake of killing. The townspeople make a lot of fuss about these wild men of theirs and live in fear of them, and so the four of us, young men and strangers, had to behave with notable propriety and good manners, even at a distance, so as not to be mistaken for marauders or murderers. Once they saw we were harmless, they were generous and talkative, giving us anything they thought we wanted. Most of their towns were small, pleasant places with wood-beamed adobe houses, stuccoed white, shaded by avocado trees. They all stayed in town all year, because in a summer house a family would not be safe from the bands of young men. But they said they used to go to summer houses, and it's only in the last couple of generations that the young men have gotten irresponsible. They seemed to me foolish to let such an imbalance occur and continue, but perhaps they had some reason for it. The different peoples of those many canyons speak several different languages, but their towns and way of life were pretty much all alike. There were always people in the towns who could use toque so we could converse. At one of their exchanges, we sent messages to the Wakwaha exchange to tell the finders and our households that all was well with us so far. Towards the inner base of the peninsula, the ridges flatten down into a hot, sandy country, not lived in by human people, which runs 2 full days' walk to the southwest coast of the inland sea. The beaches are broad and low, with sea marshes and dunes and brackish, boggy lakes inland for miles. Farther south, steep, desolate mountains run between east and west. The inland sea along that coast is very shallow, crowded with sandbars and islands, and on those islands is where they grow the cotton. The cotton people call themselves Asudegd. There are a lot of them, some thousands, living on the islands and at places on the coast where rivers come down from the mountains. They have salt water everywhere, but not much fresh. The sea is warm there, and it's warm country, though nothing like so hot, they say, as across those desolate mountains on the shores of the Omorn Sea. There are some severely poisoned areas in their country, but since it's so dry, the stuff stays put in the ground, and they know where not to go. Across the inland sea, in the northeast, the cotton people look up to that tall peak of the range of light which we call South Mountain and they call Old Lion Mountain. Usually all one can see is the murk from the volcanoes south of it. It is important in their thoughts, but they never go to it. They say it is sacred, and its paths are not to be walked. But what about the Gongon people who live all around South Mountain? That sort of idea is typical of the cotton people. They are not reasonable about some things. It is my opinion that people who have too much to do with the sea and use boats a great deal have their minds affected by it. At any rate, their towns are different from the towns of the peninsular peoples. The cotton people dig in and build underground with only a couple of feet of wall above ground for windows, like a hayamas. The roof is a low dome covered with sod, so from any distance you don't see a town but a patch of hummocks. In among the roofs are all kinds of shrubs, trees and vines they have down there, palm, avocado, big orange and lemon and grapefruit trees, carob and date, the same kinds of eucalyptus we have, and some I never saw before, are some of their trees. The vines flower splendidly. The trees make shade above ground, and the houses stay cool underground. The arrangement looks odd, but is reasonable. They have no problems draining their houses, as we do our hayamas, because it's so dry there. Though when it rains, sometimes it rains hard, and they get flooded out, they said. Their sacred places are some distance outside the towns, and are artificial mountains, hillocks with ritual paths round and round them, and beautiful small buildings or enclosures on top. We didn't mess with any of that. Patience said it was best to keep clear out of foreigners' sacred places until invited into them. He said one reason he liked the Amaranth people, with whom he had stayed several times, was that they had no sacred places at all. People tend to get testy about those places. But the cotton people were already testy. Although they hadn't replied or sent any message on the exchange, they were angry that we had sent back their woven goods and hadn't sent the usual amount of wine, and right away we were in trouble there. All we had to do was say we had come from the Valley of the Na, and the hornets began to buzz. We had to get into one of their boats, flat things that felt very unsafe, and go out to the most important island. As soon as we got on the water, though it was entirely calm and smooth, I got sick again. I have a very delicate sense of balance, and the unsteadiness of boats affects my inner ear. The cotton people had no understanding of this at all. The Phalaris Islanders had made jokes about it, but the cotton people were contemptuous and rude. We passed many large islands, and the cotton people kept pointing and saying, "Cotton, cotton, see the cotton? Everybody knows we grow the best cotton. People as far north as Crater Lake know it. Look at that cotton," and so on. The cotton fields were not very impressive at that time of year, but we nodded and smiled and behaved with admiration and propriety, agreeing with everything they said. After coasting a flat island miles long, we turned northeast and landed on a small island with a good view of the mountains, all the south end of the range of light, and the bare, raw Havil range in the south. The whole island was a town. Hundreds of hummock roofs, some of them turfed, others naked sand, and trees and bushes in patterns among the hummocks, and flower beds, also in patterns, with little paths between and through. They are strong on paths down there, but you have to know which ones are to be walked on. We had been traveling all that day, and 30 days before it, and it was sunset by the time we landed on this island, but they hardly stopped to give us dinner before they took us straight into the town council meeting. And there they hardly said anything polite or appropriate about our having come all that way to talk with them before they started saying, "Where's the sweet Betebis? And why did you send our goods back? Do we not have an agreement made 60 years ago? Every year since then it has been honored and renewed until this year. Why have you of the Wali broken your word?" They spoke good toke, but they always said Wali for valley and whine for wine. Patience knew what he was doing when he took his middle name. He listened to them endlessly and remained alert, yet never frowned or nodded or shook his head. Peregrine, Gold, and I imitated him as well as we could. After a great many of them had said their say, a little woman stood up and a little man beside her. They both had twisted bodies and humped backs and looked both young and old. One of them said, "Let our guests have a word now," and the other said, "Let the wine people speak." They had authority, those little twins. The others all shut up like clams. Patience let there be silence for some while before he spoke. And when he spoke, his voice was grave and soft, so that they had to stay quiet to hear what he said. He was cautious and polite. He said a lot about the fitness of the agreement, and its admirable age and convenience, and the unsurpassed quality of a Sudegged cotton, known to be the best cotton from Crater Lake to the O'Morn Break, from the ocean coast to the range of heaven. He got fairly eloquent in here. And then he quieted down again and spoke a little sadly about how time blunts the keenest knife and changes the meaning of words and the thoughts in human minds, so that finally the firmest knot must be retied and the sincerest word spoken once again. And then he sat down. There was a silence. I thought he had awakened reason in them, and they would agree at once. I was very young. The same woman who had talked the most before got up and said, "Why didn't you send 40 barrels of sweet Betebus wine like always before?" I saw that the difficult part was only beginning. Patience had to answer that question, and also say why we had sent back their woven goods. For a long time he didn't. He kept talking in metaphors and images and skirting around the issues, and after a while the little twisty twins began answering him the same way. And then, before anything that meant much had been said, it was so late that they called the meeting off for the night and finally took us to an empty house where we could get some sleep. There was no heating and one tiny electric light. The beds stood up on legs and were lumpy. It went on like that for 3 more days. Even Patience said he hadn't expected them to go on arguing, and that probably the reason they argued so much was that they were ashamed of something. If so, it was our part not to shame them further, so we could not say anything about the poor quality of the raw cotton for the last several years, or even about the sleazy they had tried to foist off on us. We just stayed calm and sad and said that indeed we regretted not shipping the sweet wine which we grew especially for them, but said nothing about why we had not shipped it. And sure enough, little by little it came out that they had had a lot of bad things happen in the last 5 years. A cotton leaf virus mutation that was hard to control, and 3 years of drought, and a set of unusually severe earthquakes that had drowned some of their islands and left the water on others too saline even for their hardy cotton. All these things they seemed to consider their own fault, things to be ashamed of. "We have walked in the wrong paths," they kept saying. Patience and Peregrine, who also spoke for us, never said anything about these troubles of theirs, but began talking about troubles we had had in the valley. They had to exaggerate a good deal, because things had been going particularly well for the winemakers, and the 4th and 5th years before had been great vintages of both Ganais and Fetali. But in any kind of farming, there are always troubles enough to talk about. And the more they told or invented about unseasonable frosts and unsuccessful fermentations, the more the cotton people went on about their own troubles, until they had told everything. They seemed relieved then, and they gave us a much nicer house to stay in, well lighted and warm, with little paths all over the roof marked out with white shells and fumo balls. And at last they began to renegotiate the contract. It had taken Patience 7 days to get them to do that. When we got down to it at last, it was very simple. The terms were about the same as they had been, with more room for negotiation each year through the exchange. Nothing was said about why they hadn't used the exchange to explain their behavior earlier. They were still touchy and unreasonable if you said the wrong thing. We said that we would accept short staple cotton until they had the long staple in quantity again, and we would send a double quantity of sweet Betebus with the spring shipment. However, underweight bales would be refused, and we did not want woven goods, since we preferred to make our own. There was trouble on this point. The woman with the thirst for sweet Betebus got poisonous about it, and went on for hours about the quality and beauty of the fabrics of a Sudegged. But by now Patience and the little twisty twins were friends of the heart, and the contract at last was spoken for cotton in the bale only, no fabrics. After speaking the contract, we stayed on 9 days more, for politeness, and because Patience and the twins were drinking together. Gold was busy with his maps and notes, and Peregrine, a person whom everybody everywhere liked, was always talking with townspeople or going off in boats with them to other islands. The boats were a little better than bundles of tule reeds. I generally hung around with some young women who were weavers there. They had some fine mechanical looms, solar-powered, that I made notes on for my teacher, Soaring, and also they were kind and friendly. Patience warned me that it's better not to have a relation of sex with people in foreign countries until you know a good deal about their customs and expectations concerning commitment, marriage, contraception, techniques, and so on. So I just flirted and did some kissing. The cotton women kissed with their mouths wide open, which is surprising if you aren't expecting it, and disagreeably wet, but very voluptuous, which was trying under the circumstances. Peregrine came back from another island one day with a queer expression. He said, "We've been fooled, Patience." Patience just waited, as usual. Peregrine explained. He had met, in a town on one of the northernmost islands, some of the sailors of the ships that had brought the cotton to Sed and taken our wine back, the same people who had explained that they were just sailors and knew nothing about the cotton people and didn't even speak their language. There they were, living in that cotton town and speaking the language like natives, which they were. They were sailors by art or trade and hadn't wanted to get into trouble with us by arguing about the goods or the contract. They hadn't told anybody except the people on their own island about their private supply of sweet betebes, either. They laughed like crazy about it when they met him, Peregrine said. They told him that the man they had told us was one of the cotton people was the only one who wasn't. He was a poor half-wit who had wandered in from the desert and couldn't speak much of any language. Patience was silent long enough that I believed he was angry, but then he began to laugh, and we all laughed. He said, "Go see if that crew will take us back north by sea." But I suggested that we go home by land. We left a few days later. It took us 2 months to go along the eastern coast of the inland sea to Rekwit, from which we sailed across to Tatselots in a great storm. But all that journey is another story, which I may tell later. Since we went down there, there hasn't been any more trouble with the cotton people, and they have always sent us good, long staple cotton. They are not an unreasonable people, except in making little paths everywhere and being ashamed to admit they have had troubles. Notes. 1. Peregrine. Yestick, the peregrine falcon, a common finder's name. 2. Fumo balls. Fumo is a word for concretions, usually whitish or yellowish, of ancient industrial origin, of nearly the same specific gravity as ice. There are fumo belts in certain parts of the oceans, and some beaches are almost entirely composed of small particles of fumo.